Save big at Menards and prepare for the summer heat with a new air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Cool your space from anywhere in the room with three cooling speeds and a remote control. Save big money on Denali Air air conditioners. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. It was another bad week for President Trump as the president fails to condemn hate groups after a tragic death in Charlottesville, Virginia. Craig Gilbert talks about how Wisconsin Republicans are reacting. And in Wisconsin, another step forward for the giant Foxconn development could come as early as today in the state assembly. We speak with Jason Stein in Madison. And Senator Ron Johnson is calling on the State Department to get answers after the death of a young Wisconsin woman at a Mexican resort. Raquel Rutledge has the latest. All that and more today from the best political team in Wisconsin, today on Politics. Good afternoon. I'm David Haynes, the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics. Well, the big Foxconn development could take a step forward this afternoon after debate in the Wisconsin Assembly. We spoke with Jason Stein in Madison about that story. So, Jason, the Foxconn deal that's been pushed by Governor Walker and the administration is likely to come up for a vote in the Assembly, I think you were saying, later today. Is it likely to pass the Assembly today?
Yes, absolutely. It'll pass the Assembly late this afternoon or early evening. And I think the question will be, you know, will it pass with only Republican votes, or will there be at least a handful of Democrats that will vote for the bill because, you know, this plant that could have up to 13,000 jobs would be sited in the Racine or Kenosha areas where you have a lot of Democratic lawmakers.
Where are the Democrats at in that region? People like Corey Mason and so forth.
Corey Mason, Peter Barca, yeah, who is the Assembly Minority Leader, you know, Representative Onstad, who's also from, you know, the Kenosha area. In the Senate, you have Bob Wirch, who's from Pleasant Prairie. So, you know, you do have some Democrats there in southeastern Wisconsin, and some of them, I think, have been agonizing over this vote in that they have some concerns about it, but they also see some potential for their area.
So what questions are the Democrats raising, especially those in that region?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think two things. One, they're looking at the cost per job of this deal, which is higher than the deals that have typically been done in this state in the past, and higher than the national average in terms of the cost per job. And, you know, that's maybe a little less of a concern if you live in that area, because it's taxpayers from all over the state, you know, paying for something that would be in your area. But then there's also some exemptions from environmental rules that are in the bill that will be considered today in the Assembly. And obviously for Democrats who, you know, many of them have strong environmental convictions, that's something that they're also really taking pause over.
Yeah. So what about the state Senate? Once the Assembly passes it, it would move to the Senate. When is that likely to happen? And is it likely to sail through the Senate as well?
Right. So what's going to happen first is there's the expectation that the legislature's budget committee will hold a hearing on this bill and then next week, and probably vote on it next week. And one thing that Senate Republican leaders have said is they have said that it doesn't make sense for the Assembly to take up the bill before it goes through the Joint Finance Committee and gets those changes that might be made. But, you know, there's a difference of opinions between the House on this. Obviously, the Assembly is led by Speaker Robin Voss, who is from the Racine area and might actually have the plant in his district, depending on where it gets cited. And the Speaker is, you know, very aggressive and passionate about moving this legislation forward quickly.
Are we likely to see any changes to the bill in when it reaches the Senate? There's been some talk about some kind of guaranteed number of jobs.
Right. I think we are likely to see some changes. You know, I don't expect that those changes will be substantial. There was definitely talk from Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald for a while that he might put in a minimum number of jobs guarantee. So this deal, you know, basically the company would not get jobs credits until it hired people and paid them, but they could pick up some money from taxpayers for helping to offset their investment in a plan. In fact, up to $1.35 billion in cash. And what the majority leader was talking about was sort of putting a jobs requirement and attaching it to that plant money as well to say, look, if we're going to give you more than $1 billion for the plant, we want a minimum number of jobs that are going to come out of this. But he seemed to back off that after he raised that issue, saying that, well, he thought that the contract between the state and the company might be able to lay out those provisions. What we haven't heard from the governor's administration is whether they're willing to drive a hard bargain and insist that that be in the contract.
One final question. The state released a study that was done on behalf for WEDC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, this week, that for Baker Tilly consultancy, that appear to show some different numbers in jobs. Was that study based sort of on the Ernst & Young report, or was that a complete brand new analysis of the deal?
Sure. So we have two different accounting and consulting firms that have taken a look at this deal and how many, you know, what the ripple effect of this deal might be. Neither one of the reports looked at whether or not it was reasonable to think that the Foxconn plant could create up to 13,000 jobs, which is what the company has said that it expects to eventually create at the plant. Both of those studies just took that number at face value, that we'd have a plant with 13,000 jobs, and then they came to different conclusions about how big the ripple effect of that would be. The study paid for by Foxconn found that it would create 22,000 additional jobs in the area at suppliers or just other businesses like restaurants. And then the study paid for by state taxpayers found that it would be a minimum of 12,000 to 18,000. So somewhat below what the Foxconn paid study had found.
Right. And the number of jobs affects the cost to taxpayers eventually, doesn't it?
It does, in part because, you know, as a manufacturer, Foxconn is never going to pay any or virtually any income taxes in Wisconsin because we exempt manufacturers from corporate and income taxes. So really, and then we're going to be making, you know, up to $2.85 billion in cash payments to get the plant. So a lot of where the taxpayers might recoup their investment is in other supplier companies that would relocate to the area or get more business. And so it becomes really important to try and estimate how big that ripple effect would be.
All right. Jason Stein in Madison. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, David.
And now sticking with the Foxconn story for just a moment, we spoke with Tom Kircher of PolitiFact Wisconsin. And PolitiFact Wisconsin has done a number of fact checks on statements that politicians and political groups have been making about the developments. Go to Tom. So, Tom, PolitiFact Wisconsin has been doing some ratings of statements that politicians have made and political groups have made about
right.
the Foxconn deal.
Right.
So let's take a look at a few of those. First one is from Governor Scott Walker. He said that Foxconn is bringing 13,000 high-tech jobs to Wisconsin. What's your rating on that?
We rated that half true. The way the governor states it sounds as though it's a done deal or certain to happen. At this point, Foxconn has said it plans to bring up to 13,000 jobs, but there's no signed agreement for any minimum number that they've agreed to create.
And if anything, that's down the road a few years anyway. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So next, let's go to a statement from Melissa Sargent. She said that 3,000 jobs will cost Wisconsin taxpayers more than $3 billion, more than $1 million in taxpayers. Dollars per job. Mm-hmm. Is that true or false?
The way she does her math, that's false. There's the only way that Foxconn would receive the full $3 billion from Wisconsin is if it creates 13,000 jobs, not 3,000. So her statement is false, although it's important to remember that depending on how much Foxconn invests and how many jobs are created, theoretically, it's possible that the state incentives could amount to $1 million per job.
Yeah, the cost per job could grow higher depending on number of jobs.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So let's take a look at one more that PolitiFact Wisconsin has evaluated. This is by the political group from the left side of the political spectrum, One Wisconsin Now. And they claimed that Wisconsin's $3 billion incentive offered to Foxconn is, quote, the largest gift ever by a state to a foreign company, end quote. Mm-hmm. True or false?
We rated that statement half true. The problem with the statement is that the $3 billion being offered by the state would not be a gift. It's not simply cash that it would be turning over to Foxconn. The money would be tied to jobs created.
Tied to performance, as the governor has said.
Right, and how much money the company invests in the plant. However, the One Wisconsin Now is correct that if Wisconsin's $3 billion offer does go through, it would be the largest subsidy ever given by a state to a foreign company.
All right. Tom Kircher from PolitiFact Wisconsin, thanks so much for being with us. And look for Tom's work and the work of the other journalists working on PolitiFact at jsonline.com. We want to return to Washington now and Craig Gilbert to talk about Donald Trump's very bad weeks. Here's Craig. Well, Craig, welcome to On Politics. So Donald Trump found himself once again in a crisis over his handling of the Charlottesville unrest last week and, of course, the tragic death of a protester down there. First, refusing to condemn by name the white supremacists who were marching, then doing so, and then backtracking in a rather bizarre press conference on Tuesday. But I want to just bring our viewers up to date. Some tweets this morning. Trump again is doubling down on this position, first attacking two sitting U.S. senators of his own party, and then tweeting, "It's sad to see the history and culture of this great country being ripped apart. You can't change history. So foolish. Also, the great beauty is being taken out of our cities, towns, and parks." He's talking about the monuments being taken down to Confederates. Craig, what position does this leave Republicans of his own party in?
Well, an incredibly painful one, I would say. And we've seen this throughout the Trump presidency, the short Trump presidency, where Republican politicians have been constantly placed in the position of being forced to respond to things that Trump has said or done, to controversial things he said or done, to things that they either may adamantly disagree with or just subjects they don't want to talk about and would rather ignore. And, they're caught in a terrible place where the president is attacking them for not getting their agenda through Congress. At the same time, he's making it more difficult, arguably, for them to do anything in Congress with these firestorms and these uproars. And they're also tortured over whether to criticize the president directly when they do disagree with him. We saw that again with Charlottesville, with the president's comments about Charlottesville, where not very many Republican members of Congress criticized the president by name. A larger number distanced themselves from what the president was saying and expressed their own points of view. If you look at the Wisconsin congressional delegation, only one, Mike Gallagher, the freshman Republican from Green Bay, criticized President Trump by name over how he's handled the Charlottesville issue.
So, Craig, why not criticize Trump by name? I mean, these are neo-Nazis, white supremacists marching in a community. There was a time not long ago when that would have been unthinkable.
Why not? Well, the president still politically has a lot of support from Republican voters. So there has been this persistent fear on the part of Republican politicians that if they become in opposition to the president or criticize a pretty thin-skinned president, that they'll face a backlash from people, voters in their own party. They may face a primary if they are up for re-election. Again, you alluded to the tweets this morning, the president's tweets against Lindsey Graham in South Carolina and Jeff Flake in Arizona. That's a pretty good example of how the president will turn his fire on his critics within his own party, just as he turned his fire on House Speaker Paul Ryan during the campaign. And Ryan found himself sort of defined as a Trump critic within his party and has tried very hard, as we've seen, since Trump became president, to not be defined as a Trump critic within his party, because he's trying to get his agenda passed.
So they're still trying to do that. And Mitch McConnell, of course, found himself in the crosshairs this week.
Absolutely. So, you know, you can find yourself under attack, a Republican, from your president, either for failing to succeed in getting legislation passed in Congress, or if he, again, if he perceives you as critical of his rhetoric, that's going to happen too. So that's a very obviously uncomfortable position. I mean, a lot of these Republicans have been attacked and criticized for being too timid, and that's a legitimate issue. At the same time, they're kind of in a no-win position, and it's going to be a very painful period going forward through this midterm election cycle with the weight of an unpopular president hanging on them. So far, an inability to really do the big dramatic things in Congress they want to do, and then this just sort of constant drumbeat of controversy on very painful hot-button issues in which they're being forced to sort of weigh in when the president is saying things that make them very uncomfortable.
So talk about this Republican agenda. To what extent does this make it harder, this controversy over Charlottesville, make it harder for the Republicans to focus, say, on tax reform?
Well, it makes it harder, but you can't put it all on that. In other words, they have yet to show that the consensus exists within the party to do some of these things. In some cases, the things they're talking about doing may not be, the problem may be just that they're not politically popular with the American public. In other cases, it may just be also that the consensus doesn't exist across the spectrum of the Republican Party in Congress. That was certainly the case. Both the things were the case with health care, where it was an unpopular bill, and also in the Senate, there was no consensus in the party on what kind of bill they needed to pass. And it remains to be seen whether that's going to be true of tax reform, which is the next big item. Tax reform is already more difficult because of the failure to pass health care reform. That makes the numbers harder to add up in the tax reform proposals. But this obviously doesn't help. It's at a minimum a distraction. It creates division and friction within the Republican Party, and you have someone like Paul Ryan who's been trying very hard to sort of message on tax reform now for the past month, and it all gets kind of lost in the uproar and the clamor over something like Charlottesville and the president's comments.
All right. Well, Craig Gilbert in Washington, thanks so much. So I'm joined back in studio now with Mary Spicuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Dan Bysa, columnist.
We're live.
For the Journal Sentinel. We are live after a couple of taped segments. So, Dan, to follow up on Trump's really horrible, very bad week so far, it's not over yet.
Which, you know, it could have been over in a day.
Yeah.
By Monday afternoon, it could have been done. But, you know, every time there's like another step, something else happens. And then, you know, last night there was this memo that Trump's attorney was circulating that was not a good memo that he's forwarding everybody.
Right.
And then Bannon goes on and does this interview, this bizarre interview with a liberal writer, Robert Kuttner from the American Prospect, in which he calls and he's critical of a number of people, including Trump. And then Trump gets up this morning and starts tweeting. So it's just like, you know, this is an exercise in how long you can extend a story. But yeah, the Bannon thing was interesting to me just because, one, he spoke very openly about his wars and battles with particular individuals within agencies. It's the sort of thing that you expect to hear from an insider talking off the record. And I think he thought he was off the record. And you know, there was a story earlier this week in which, Trump was supposedly very upset because he believes Bannon is a major leaker. And that's one of the reasons he's thinking about replacing him. And it was very noteworthy during the third Trump appearance that how he referred to Bannon during the entire interview. When they were asked about him, he doesn't refer to him by his first name. He calls him Mr. Bannon. Mr. Bannon came on the campaign late, had no impact on the primaries. You know, I like him and he's a friend, but basically we'll see what happens.
It's not my Steve any longer. So, Mary, Bannon has long sort of been seen as a channel for the alt-right, but in this interview he essentially called the marchers in Charlottesville clowns, and he didn't seem to be the platform provider for the alt-right.
He did not, although then President Trump was criticized for the platform he gave to, I would say, not going beyond alt-right to white nationalists and white supremacists this week. So they're probably feeling pretty good about their week, despite Bannon's criticism.
David Duke has been very complimentary, the former Klan leader.
I think there's a difference in Bannon's interview. It's clear he thinks this group, the group of protesters, is an incredibly tiny group of people that should be just dismissed, and that he thinks that the media is giving them too much attention. And he clearly doesn't identify with them, even though he has said, and he said previously, that Breitbart was a platform for the alt-right. Now he's very dismissive of the alt-right. And all of this comes out when this recent book, The Devil's Bargain, comes out about the relationship between Trump and...
Trump apparently hated it because it gave Bannon a lot of credit for being the force behind Trump.
Yeah. It's interesting because I feel like people want to separate the alt-right from Nazis, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and I think a lot of people are questioning whether there is actually a line between the two. And President Trump kind of wants to do the both sides, the alt-right and the alt-left. And
there were many good people marching
there
who just didn't want to take down
and
the
statues. And it's like, who are the white supremacists and the white nationalists on this alt-left that you're
speaking interesting about? Because Trump is like the ultimate marketer, and alt-right is an ultimate marketing thing. It's just rebranded, refashioned a white supremacy and white nationalism that you give a good name and you put that out there and everybody's a little more comfortable with it. It is interesting here locally about Craig talked about how some of the members of Congress have responded, and Gwen Moore calling for ousting him. There is another race going on, that's the Senate race, where none of the three Republicans thinking about or in the race to challenge Tammy Baldwin, Kevin Nicholson, Leah Vukmir, or Eric Hovde they've said nothing on this. They've been completely silent.
Not even condemning white nationalism.
Nothing.
They've said response.
No response. Zero response.
Which most Republicans who have wrestled with not wanting to criticize Trump have been willing to say, you know.
Sort of the Paul Ryan position.
Sure. Yeah.
You don't name them, but you condemn.
You don't name them, but you distance yourself and condemn Nazis.
All right, well, let's move on to another story, and we'll come back to our panelists here. I spoke earlier this morning with Raquel Rutledge about these really disturbing stories coming out of Mexico involving American tourists who have suffered blackouts there after drinking at the resort. So here's Raquel. So Raquel, you've been reporting now for a few weeks, a couple of months actually, on a number of people who have been reporting blackouts at Mexican resorts, apparently related to alcohol that they've consumed there. Some of the folks have been assaulted. At least, well, there's been several deaths, one including a young woman from Pewaukee. How many victims have you identified at this point?
Well, I mean, my phone just keeps ringing, and I keep getting more and more emails from people. It's above 70 now, with people that are calling to say they've had similar experiences after having consumed alcohol at various resorts. It's not one particular resort, but various resorts all around Cancun, Playa del Carmen, Los Cabos, Puerto Vallarta.
And the U.S. government issued a travel advisory, I think, through the State Department about the problem of potentially tainted alcohol. And then the Mexican government has taken a step, to remove some of that alcohol, right, or seize it?
Well, they've had a long-standing problem with counterfeit alcohol in Mexico. It's known, they've known it for years, and it's something they have improved in the last couple of years, going from 43% of all the alcohol consumed in Mexico being illegal. Doesn't mean it's all tainted, doesn't mean it's all contaminated. It means it's sold or produced illegally, so it might not have the proper tax stamps. It could be counterfeit, could be tainted, so all of that falls into that category. But the most recent figures say 36%. So that's still a large quantity of alcohol that's, you know, unregulated. They did do a sweep and go through a lot of the resorts and nightclubs in Cancun and Playa del Carmen, the tourist hotspots, in the last couple of weeks, and seized about 10,000 gallons of tainted alcohol. Well, they seized 10,000 gallons from one. They found one manufacturer who was had they called it bad manufacturing practices, and so those they took off the market. And our State Department did issue, it's not actually a security, it's not a travel alert, it's not a formal one of their highest level travel alerts. Basically, they updated their information on Mexico just to alert people to, hey, be on the lookout.
Yeah, yeah. And what is it about this alcohol that is problematic?
Well, that, I mean, that's the good question. That's a great question. It's unknown exactly. You know, there's, in the past, it's been known the counterfeit alcohol can have high levels of methanol in it. It can be made with industrial alcohol with flavorings. One of the people that I interviewed that owns a liquor store down in Mexico talked about how it's made, you know, in big vats and just with powdered flavoring, for example, for like tequila flavoring. So it's industrial alcohol, but just flavored to taste like tequila. Mm-hmm. But the most, you know, the government went in, they did this sweep, but they didn't find, they said so far, they haven't found the contaminants. They found unlabeled stuff, they found expired stuff, but as of late, they didn't find the contamination.
Well, it appears that there's a likelihood that people are being taken advantage of, so do you know how that's worked? I mean, people end up blacked out in their room or somewhere else, and they've been assaulted, they've had money taken, you know, they go to the hospital, yeah, and have to pay thousands of dollars before they can be treated. Is there some kind of conspiracy here with the resort owners?
I mean, it's hard to know. That's the theory is because the hospitals have contracts with the resorts. So the thinking is, you know, could they be in cahoots? It seems to me from the research that I've done that there are multiple things going on at once here. I mean, it does seem to me that some folks are being targeted, possibly, you know, being drugged. You know, because they ended up being sexually assaulted, robbed, you know, different things have happened to them, where other people have these blackouts and nothing, no other, aside from being very violently ill, they don't have any other, you know, obvious crimes that have been committed. But the thing that was really interesting that you know, it's not just to be dismissed as, oh, you're drunk, which is what has been the take. All these years has been like, oh, you're just drunk, you're drunk.
You drank too much.
And especially at these all-inclusives, people have been really quiet about it and keeping to themselves when they have these instances happen to them because they're embarrassed, somewhat ashamed, and they think nobody will believe them. You were at an all-inclusive, oh, sure, you had two, you know.
Right.
So there's that, and that's allowed it to carry on. But what's particularly interesting that makes me, you know, really know that certainly there's something going on here is when you have two people blacking out at the same time. I mean, that doesn't happen when you're drunk. That does not happen from drinking. That two people of different sizes, big men that are 6'3", 200 pounds, with petite women that are, you know, 110 pounds, drinking the same thing, passing out at the same time, and waking up at the same time.
So there's something going on. So Senator Johnson, just in the last day, has called on what the State Department to try to get to the bottom of Abby Connor's death, right? She's the Pewaukee woman that we talked about.
Yeah, I mean, he wants answers about her death, and then but he's also looking into the bigger issue. In that letter, he speaks to, hey, we want answers, what's going on? How is the State Department keeping track of this? The State Department right now, as it stands, does very little, and I think it's very surprising from all the interviews that I've done, everybody that's run into trouble down there, they're surprised, shocked that the U.S. consulate down there has very little authority. Mm-hmm. They can't translate for them, they can't advocate for them, they really can't do much. What they can do, though, is they have the authority to keep data. Like, if you get calls from people that say, hey, I feel like I've been drugged, we've been robbed, we've been assaulted, they don't have those numbers. They don't keep, when you ask them, hey, how often does this happen? They have no idea. They can tell you how many people died, how many people drowned, how many people have been killed, but they don't have any more specifics. And so nothing flagged the problem for them because they don't keep information that way.
Right.
Nothing's stopping them from doing that. So I think the Homeland Security Committee, Senate Homeland Security Committee, is pressing, you know, is pushing the State Department to, you know, step it up and figure out what you can do to be helpful.
All right, Raquel, thanks so much. Look for Raquel's report. There was a new one just posted yesterday at JS Online. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So now let's turn to winners and losers. Mary, who's your loser this week?
I'm going to say Paul Ryan because it seems like he cannot win in his relationship with President Donald Trump. He took heat from Trump supporters when he criticized him. Now in situations like this with Trump's comments in the wake of the violence in Charlottesville, he's wanted to condemn white supremacists but not criticize the president. A lot of Republicans seem to be in this delicate dance situation, but he's being criticized now, you know, really from people saying, like, how can you not criticize the president for his comments?
So hard job just got harder.
Yes.
Who's your winner?
I'm going to say Scott Walker, because while he's doing the delicate dance over Trump, he does seem to be getting support for Foxconn. It looks like it's going to be advancing with enough Republican support to pass. So don't want to jump ahead of it before it happens, but it looks like he's going to get that through.
All right, smooth sailing, it looks like, for Foxconn. Okay, Dan, who's your winner this week?
Both of mine have to do with the Republican race for U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate used to be called the Millionaires Club. Now it's starting to look like the Billionaires Club. This week we find out that Leah Vukmir, one of the Republicans thinking about running, has Diane Hendricks, the billionaire, on her side. This puts her up against Kevin Nicholson, who has Richard Elyne, another billionaire, up against each other. And that leads us to my loser. We have Eric Hovde, who's just a millionaire, and maybe has to find his own Wisconsin billionaire to support him, to get him through.
Or Illinois.
Doesn't matter where. I mean, actually, the Elynes live in
Northern. Elyne live in
right, but yeah. Yeah. And it's funny that this is all happening 15, 16 months out from the election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got a ways to go. All right, we have time for one viewer question. It comes from John. Let's give it to Dan. So this is regarding your report recently about a meeting that Joel Clayfish, a state rep, went to.
With a group called the Three Percenters.
The Three Percenters, and he asks, so does Clayfish believe that white supremacy is a conservative value?
I don't think so. Actually, there's been some misunderstanding online about the Three Percenters. They're an anti-government, pro-gun group. They're one of these groups that say that they're going to, you know, they're going to take on the government if it infringes on their Second Amendment rights. I saw nothing about white supremacy or race on any of their material. It's become important because the guy out in Oklahoma who had that foiled bomb plot said he was sympathetic to their ideology. Joel Clayfish says he knew next to nothing about the group, even though the leader of the group is a friend of his since he was kids. But yeah, I don't think, based on this, there's nothing that would suggest Joel Clayfish is, you know, supports white supremacy. So I would say that question is false.
All right.
Can I join white? Can I join PolitiFact?
Maybe you can. All right, so that's our show for this week. I'm Dave Haynes with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My thanks to Jason Stein, Craig Gilbert, Mary Spacuzza, Dan Bice, Raquel Rutledge, and Tom Kircher. Until next week, thanks so much.